good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll hear a cast of other characters. John, KC2, WGB, Paul, WS2N. And quite often we hear from some guy named Hal, K6DPZ. This group of guys gather every Sunday night to help teach each other ham radio. We believe this is educational. And this is the 31.5 year. This is TechNet number 1480 of the series that began way back in September of 1982. So, time we get started, and I hear tell that we're going to be discussing resonance and antenna impedance matching and things like that. So, do ham radio operators use antennas? Oh boy, do they. And as of some of the experience I've had in the last couple of weeks, I'm slowly discovering that we amateur radio operators, we backyard tinkerers with antennas, are in some respects doing better than the professionals who have got doctorate degrees and 20 and 30 and 40 years of experience and heavy computer modeling under their belt. There are some cases where they're not doing quite as well, it says here, according to some of the evidence that I've seen. Alrighty, John and I were up pretty late last night, way beyond sunrise, we got interested in the subject, so let's hope that John and I don't fall asleep. We think we won't. We took a little bit of a nap today. A person signs in, let me drop. Signs into the TechNet by giving that crew and me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. That means you do have a question or a comment. You do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. We don't need great big long lists of people saying that, hey, I'm listening. After 31 years, we believe somebody is listening. And by way of Echolink and IRLP, quite often we get check-ins from people far and wide out there, pretty far away. Alrighty, if you've got your questions and call letters and name ready to go, give us your call letters and name right now. K2RI, they'll be listening.
Take just a point of information. The 900 link is up, so I didn't know if you were aware of that. Eric has completed it.
Roger, Roger. Joe, and it's RYY, we got you. John, I got your comment that the link is working. Let me take a quick listen. Sure enough, I'm hearing myself with no delay. So the system is getting better and better. Yeah, more and more complicated. Look out. Murphy's Law is going to be coming along. Well, Elmer's Law. You guys maybe have heard this silly joke about Elmer's Law saying that Murphy was an optimist. The real world's a little worse. All right. The B2RYY and KC2WG, so GB so far sending in. Anyone else with a question or a comment?
QYT? Yes.
I heard something like QYT and yes. So give me that full call again.
KC2PYT? Yes.
And Mr. PYT, what is your name, sir?
This is Ed.
Very fine, Ed. All right, so far we got Joe and Ed. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Call letters and name, please, right now.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
35, we got Steve. KC2MDP. So, Joe, Ed, Steve, John. Who else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS Plant Paul with the space report. Good evening, everybody on the net.
Glad to hear from you, Paul. And I'd love to hear what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration are doing. And they're always doing interesting things. One last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now for the TechNet.
Dick, you did put me in for a question, correct?
Roger, Dodger. You're on the list. I think I heard somebody try to get through who didn't make it. Want to give it another try? In case somebody didn't have a TL tone. You do have to have a 146, here we go, 136.5 TL operational in order to get through on this machine. Way back in the old days, that used to be turned off, that function, but there's a bunch of reasons why that can no longer take place. Alrighty, I'm going to take Joe first, because he's usually got brief questions. That's a funny one. And then John in that order. And then Ed and Steve. So Joe, the V2LYY. How have those electrons been treating you the last week or so?
fix the feedback problem. What I did was I backed down on the mic gain. And yes, the other station was right. My radio does have a where I could listen to my audio with my headphones. Okay, so let me get straight to my my brief question. For some reason, I knew Dick was going to say that. This is a question I don't think anyone in amateur radio history ever asked. My question is, if I built a amplifier kit, like a kit, and I bought it from a manufacturer, and my question is, do I have to get it FCC approved if I put it together myself? Like, let's say if I have to put like the fans on it, maybe the outside casing with the chassis and whatnot. So that's my question. Do I have to get it FCC approved if I put the amplifier like together myself back to the net?
KC2 QIW K2RW Joe, I think we got some very good news for you. There's a slim chance what I'm about to say, which was definitely true at one time, it may have gotten modified a little bit, in which case somebody will correct me real fast. And just to backtrack a little bit, if you and I were running a taxi cab business, for instance, Joe, and we wanted to go out and buy some equipment to be able to talk to our taxi cabs. First of all, you'd have to apply to the FCC for a frequency channel, and the equipment itself would have to be type accepted. In other words, the electronics that you and I use in our taxi cab company to do dispatching to our taxi cabs, to our oil delivery trucks or whatever, it would have to be FCC-approved equipment that had been through an examination that proved that it puts out the right power on the right frequency with the right frequency stability and low enough harmonic outputs. You'd have to really prove it's good equipment for you and I to run that business. Along comes ham radio, and the FCC has given us a ridiculous amount of power. We've got frequencies all over the place. Every single octave of the band, we own frequencies. We've demonstrated that we're extremely good at self-policing. With rare exception, if somebody's doing something that's creating annoyance to other commercial services, we amateur radio operators with our fox hunting and whatever, we search that person down, stop them from doing that. As such, let me drop. With your ham radio license, you don't even have to be building somebody's approved kit. You get a wild idea in a crazy dream some night, and you said, I'm going to build a transmitter, I'm going to use this transistor upside down, I'm going to feed it to... You've taken something that's completely your design, never before existed in the world, and you put it together and you build it. The nice thing about the FCC, they have decided that we amateur radio operators, everything we build with our own hands is automatically type accepted. You better make sure it's not putting out strong harmonics. You better make sure it's got reasonably good frequency stability. It doesn't drift out of the ham bands. Otherwise, you'll get an official observer report from another ham radio operator who will officially tell you that, hey, Joe, you were outside of the 80-meter band at 3 o'clock in the morning this day, and you really ought to look into that. So we do a very good job of self-policing. So it doesn't even, the thing you build doesn't even have to be an approved kit. You can scrape up the parts out of your basement, out of a surplus shop. You throw it together, and it automatically is allowed to be on the air. You've made a virtual promise that you're not going to exceed 1,500 watts of peak envelope power, 1,000 watts of key down power. You're going to have reasonable frequency stability. You're going to stay within the ham bands frequency-wise. You're going to be using the agreed amounts of modulation. I mean, you in theory have signed an affidavit in theory when you went and applied for the ham radio license, and that was granted to you. So not to worry. Whatever you build is legal. Be a little bit careful with that. Don't abuse the privilege, but you'd be amazed what privilege you've got once you've got that FCC license in your hand, Joe. KC2 QIW. Enjoy. K2RIW, the Tech Man.
Roger that. Yeah, it's good to know because there's a company out there, like a lot of amateur radio guys don't like this company. They're called RM Italy, located, I guess, in Italy. They stepped up in their game. They're making a lot of new HF amplifiers, and some of them are approved by the FCC, and some are not because you can also go on 27 megahertz on it. I believe so. So I just told the guy, I says, can you leave some parts off it? And I'll just put some of the parts together. So that's what I did. I think I paid like only like $470 for the amp. And God, I put my word to it. This amplifier works good. It works really good. It can do about 550 watts max on sideband, but I only do about like 200 watts. So I'm really happy with it. And they do not use class H amplifiers for their amateur radio, for the HF amplifiers. So hey, that's good to know. I have one more question, but I guess I'll wait until next week. Back to the net.
Eric, let me add something.
Yeah. Eric recognized, and you accept the responsibility, Joe. When you build it yourself, you're going to use good engineering practices. You're going to make sure you don't go out of the right frequencies and whatever. Even if you go out and buy somebody else's pieces of equipment that maybe was made for some other frequency region, and you're going to convert it to a ham band, you accept the responsibility that it's going to be radiating the right amount of power, the right amount kind of modulation, the right amount of frequency stability. It's going to stay in the band. It's going to have the right amount of harmonics. You accept the responsibility, even if you're buying a commercial piece of test equipment that's type accepted for some other service. So it all comes down to you. Be a little bit careful not to abuse this beautiful privilege we've got. Now, maybe I'm misinterpreting this a little bit. Let's see, Eric, who in the broadcast world works with the FCC every single day. Let's see what Eric's got to say. KE2EJ, give us enough of our audio, Eric. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. The biggest thing that they're concerned about, actually two things. One is bandwidth of the signal that you're creating. The biggest responsibility that they're really concerned with is that the spurious emissions of you create have to be a minimum of 60 dB down. Okay, if you violate that, then you're in trouble. Actually, a lot of hams don't have the ability really to make those measurements, so that's where you've got to be careful. You know, if you're putting out a nice clean signal, you're still going to be generating harmonics. When you're talking HF, and if it's a well-designed device, it will have filters on it at the output to ensure that the harmonics you create are that far down. There are a lot of other things that they basically close their eyes to, but those are the two things that they really care about the most, and that's where you can get in trouble. So that's really what I wanted to add there. You can almost do anything that you want as long as your spurious emissions are way down, and you're going to have them. And that's why most good radios and good design, good engineering design, have output filters to make sure that your main signal is where it belongs and all the other stuff that you generate is very well attenuated. K2RIW, K2K.
K2QIQ, Lieutenant. Very fine, Eric. And I'm going to add some further comments to Eric's comments, but I'm going to first pick up Glenn, KC2QIQ. And I bet you built pieces of test equipment. You worried about whether or not you stayed in the band. Go right ahead, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Yeah, good evening, Vic. Yeah, yes, I have, Vic. And one thing that I have learned, a real cheap and dirty trick, that if you have an amplifier that isn't completely compliant, at least in the harmonic distortion end, which a lot of them aren't, especially in HF, if it's covering like a transistor amp over a lot of octaves. So one of the really neat tricks is if you have an antenna tuner between your antenna, there was one of the nice big manual ones with the big LNC in it, the big tuner inductor and everything. If you have one of those between your antenna and your amplifier, it almost always knocks everything well down below acceptable limits, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
That's not completely true.
Say completely, Eric. I said most of the time it really attenuates and knocks them down, usually well below. It's a rare occasion when they're above.
Eric, tell us where you think that might not be true.
Now, if you're transmitting 1,000 watts, and the second harmonic is very large, even though that you've created in essence, you're using a tank or a pie to make your antenna resonant, you still may have energy That's your second harmonic below that you're going to pass, so depends upon how much power you're working with and the type of output filter, output tank circuit that you're using in the tuner. The types of tuners that are automatic tuners that don't have the big coils and capacitors, they basically have relays that put them in and out. And sometimes second harmonics do pass with a reasonable amount of energy.
Eric, I did say a large external one with the large airwall capacitors and the large inductor, the tuning inductor. That's the one that I did say. I didn't say to use the one with the relays, the electronic tuning type, KC2QIQ.
We may be into the fine points here. From my point of view, a good antenna tuner goes a long way to passing the frequency you tune it to and rejecting all the others by some number of decibels. Eric's worried that it may only knock it down by 20 dB. I'm putting numbers on it. And Glenn thinks most of the time it's going to knock it down by 40 dB. And there's ways you can confirm this. And there's ways, quite often, with a manually adjustable antenna tuner, there's usually more than one way you can tune it. And some of them do a better job than others. Now, I'll admit that if you're running close to a kilowatt and your FCC requirement is supposed to be all harmonics 60 dB down, 60 dB is a million to one ratio. In other words, if you're putting out 1,000 watts of key down power, 60 dB below that is 1 milliwatt. You're supposed to have less than 1 milliwatt of harmonic power out of that transmitter. When it's on 80 meters, the 40 meter output better be 1 milliwatt when you're radiating a kilowatt. That's what the FCC numbers are saying, so to speak. And not many of us, let me drop it. Not many of us own a spectrum analyzer by which we can confirm that. However, if you're a member of a major club like this one, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, and you've got a number of members, and I'm just going to choose one of them. Eric is one of them who's got access to all kinds of fancy test equipment. Andy, W2CDL, Andy is probably down to his last two spectrum analyzers and his last two service monitors. You become friendly with Andy and say, hey, I just built this thing. I'm a little worried about it. The next time we have a tune-up clinic, can you do a check for me? Or if I give you a nice, great piece of pizza and some Coca-Cola, would you come over to my house and make a quick measurement? There's ways, if you're a member of a major club, you can get the measurement made that allow you to sleep easy on this thing. So it doesn't have to be a showstopper. That's my way of looking at it. Anybody with any further comments on this, give me a call. It is right now, K2LIW on the TechNet. Okay, that's a good sign. So, as I see it, Joe, also worry a little bit about whether or not this is a victimless crime. The 60 dB down number. If you're building a QRP transmitter that only puts out 1 watt, and if your second harmonic out of that thing is only 30 dB down instead of 60, you're still way below a milliwatt of power output on the wrong frequency. And on top of that, will that undesired second harmonic get through the antenna tuner? Will your antenna also be sufficiently resonant on the second harmonic that it radiates the signal? Even if your amplifier is putting out a whole lot of stuff that it shouldn't be, and if some of it manages to sneak past the antenna tuner, but if your antenna itself has very little response on the second harmonic, you're safe. It's what you really radiate in the air. And there's three things helping you: the tuning of the antenna, the tuning of the antenna tuner, the tuning of the final stage of the transmitter, and whether or not you're using the tube of the transmitter itself correctly and whether or not you're overdriving it with the exciter that feeds it. There's a whole bunch of things in your favor. You properly use all of those. Now, this is not a showstopper. Lots and lots of hams have built all kinds of crazy designs of their own homebrew amplifiers. They're on the air with them, and everybody's happy. So be concerned. You've got a responsibility. The FCC has allowed you to say that you're going to make sure that you're not making a nuisance of yourself. Try not to violate that. Don't make yourself unfriendly. Don't make yourself unpopular with your fellow ham radio operators during a contest because your signal is so darn wide and splatters so much that you're making a real nuisance of yourself. Respect your fellow hams. And so I think you're going to have a good bit of fun with that one, Joe. I'm going to go over to the other Joe, W2RYY, and then John in that order. Joe, W2RYY, KQLIW in a second. Go ahead, Joe.
Good evening. I have a question and a comment. I'll give you the question first.
We're ready for you, Joe.
Okay. The question is anybody listening out there on the radio land, listening to the TechNet, know of anybody that makes a device that's capable of recording touch tones and printing out a string of touch tones on paper, similar to what I guess you'd call probably something resembling like an adding machine, that type of setup to be used on a private telephone system. Back to you. I understand something like this was made like years ago, but I can't seem to find this anymore. Googling stuff around, maybe somebody might have a little more information on it. Back to you.
I do know that at one time there was an integrated circuit manufactured. I think for a short period of time, it was in one of the bubble packs at Radio Shack. So there was an integrated circuit chip that would read touch tones and give you some kind of an output. Now maybe it was a digital output that you had to interpret with a computer, and you'd like to have a nice convenient printout of the touch tones that are being received. So. Anybody know of such a machine or such a device that we can buy, or even some of the parts that Joe can put this together? If you've got any information on automatic reading of touch tone tones, give us a call at us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, we got Eric and John in that order, and probably a third person. Eric first, go ahead.
There's still about a dozen or so chips that will decode touch tones, and you'd have to build something to, make a readout of it. But there are still a number of touch tone decoders out there, specifically the manufacturers. I can't give you, I'd have to go looking for them, but there's a few. And also, there's a lot of software available, freeware, that you can use with your PC where you stick your audio into the audio input of the PC, and it will give you the readout of the numbers that are being dialed. So. There you go.
K2RWK2J. Yeah, that sounds like a nice approach. Not necessarily really portable, but if the audio in question and contains touch tones is going into your sound card, and you've got the right piece of software in that computer that interprets the touch tones for you, and then the computer itself talks to your favorite printer and it prints it out in whatever format you like, that's a very nice closed circuit solution. But does somebody make a little black box, a little blue box that does that? Maybe John knows of one. KC2WGB. K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
He might be able to find a product on eBay. It was made by Executone, and it punched a paper tape. It was used for management call in large department stores. That would be ideal for what he wants. But I don't know if that's available. They don't make them anymore, but I'm sure you'd find it on eBay or something like that.
Dick, there's a couple of manufacturers, a small manufacturer, that make it specifically for ham radio that gives you a little LCD readout and also have a printed port. I just can't think of the manufacturer at the moment.
KD2CXK with a comment. Okay, great. Pick you up in a second. John? What's your memory of that when this Executone device did exist? Was it $30 or $300? Make a guess as to what you thought it used to cost, John.
Oh, Executone was always expensive. If I remember correctly, I think it was a model. It was called a 400, and it was about $800.
Yeah, let's hope that a used one on eBay is going to be a little bit better than that. Joe is well-heeled, but there's a limit. He is a ham radio operator, and we are frugal people. Craig, do you know of a company that makes such a thing? KD2CXK. And can I use it on my telescope? I'm having some fun. K2RIW. Go ahead, Craig.
Why, yes. Today is your lucky day. Carl's Electronics. Charlie Alpha Romeo Lima Electronics has a portable, as you would say, black box for $79 with an LCD screen that you play the tones into, and it tells you them numerically on the screen. It is $79.95, and you can buy it online now or call at electronickits.com.
Oh, well done. Ain't that specific enough for you, Joe? You need a fill on that, Joe? To B2RYY?
No, negative, but I was looking for something that would actually just take, like a string of digits that would heard or decoded and print down on a piece of paper, and then go to the next string as it decoded like a next string, like later on. That's sort of what I was looking for. I'm not sure if something like that even existed. I think it existed like a while ago, but I can't remember the manufacturer of who made it, but I don't know. I haven't been able to find it recently. That's what I was basically looking for, something to print down on, like, something resembles like printer paper. See, that's like a copy of it, so you can review it later on. Something that displays on a printer, on a display, is not really useful if you're not there looking at it.
KC2PYT.
KC2PYT. Start off with your name, sir, and then wait for the beeps and tell us your information.
This is Ed. If you're willing to build one yourself, the components are actually relatively easy to come by. I was recently looking into a DTMF tone generator and found the decoder components while I was doing it. You can get a decoder, it's pretty common, called the MT8870 that'll take as an input the tone and generate as an output, the number. And you can find a way to set that up with a small printer, like a receipt printer or something like that. And you've got a pretty cheap homebrew solution that way that sounds like it would be exactly what you're looking for.
I can tell that Joe was looking for a turnkey project product ready to roll. But if worse comes to worse, building your own from the MT8870 chip. What company makes that chip, if you happen to know, Ed? Is that a Analog Devices or somebody like that? Go ahead.
Do I know they? I don't know offhand, but if you just do a quick, search on eBay or Google, they'll pop right up. Oh, wait, I've got a data sheet here. I'll tell you if you're still... Zarlink. Zarlink Semiconductor made them.
Very good information. Somebody that sounds like AOZ, give me the full call and your name, and then your information, sir. KQRIW.
KQRIW, KD2, AMZ, Mike. Well, I got a real simple one for you. I got a DTMF Android app on Google Play. $249, according to what I just looked up. So there's an app for your Android device, or your iPhone, or whatever you got.
Okay, that sounds like another very nice approach. Let's see if Joe needs a fill on that one. W-H-Y-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W.
No negative. Like you said, Dick, I was looking for something that was pretty much kind of like pre-built, something that took hook on existing private type of telephone system to be able to print out your decoded digits as its source stuff. I guess I'll have to keep on looking around. Does sound like a very popular device. And the comment I have for you is, I figured out why my Insignia decoder was displaying stuff on channel 37 when my antenna was pointed in a certain direction. It was an image, and I figured out how that worked, too.
So channel 37, apparent on your system, was an image. And what was the real channel, out of curiosity, Joe? And what brand name of digital demodulator are you using? Because I'm going to be talking to Eric, because I think it's about time I break down and buy a real television set. I'm still using a Radio Shack decoder sitting on top of my old-fashioned analog television in order to watch television. And my family's not complaining, but we are in the dark ages, if you know what I mean. So what brand are you using, and what was the real frequency that you were getting that image? Go ahead, Joe. W2LYY, K2LAW.
I use what's called an Insignia decoder. It's made by, it was marketed by Best Buy, something like that. I use a few of these things. They work actually pretty good. And the image you were seeing was something at about 46, double 46.7 megahertz or higher, approximately. So as I tuned to channel 37, it was actually looking almost channel 47, but not quite.
And it being that way, it was slightly off-kilted by about 2 megahertz. They couldn't see the information completely. It would display like an RF carrier there, but it would never give you header information and display what was actually there. But along those same lines, I found something interesting. How the thing sort of worked is, even though they would not decode picture information and give you actually a viewable picture or header information below minus 80 dBm, when I found out how the local oscillator is actually generated, it seemed to be searching, going into a search mode, across about 250 kilohertz, plus or minus the of its frequency where it's supposed to be. And if you put a signal into the receiver at about minus 120 dBm, you can get the local oscillator to actually stop and stay at one steady frequency. But yet it took a signal almost 40 dB higher for it to actually give you decoded picture information. How about that?
Yeah, this is one of the areas where I'm going to check with Eric, who is a broadcast engineer, and he's very familiar with the Trellis digital TV system. Just injecting a carrier might make the demodulator partially happy, but I think the carrier being injected must be properly phase-locked, must be on the right phase of the original carrier that was there in the original digital television transmission. That's my guess. Let's see if Eric can confirm that. KE2EJ, K2RIW, if you're available. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I stepped out of the vehicle for a minute, Vic. Why don't you run the question by me again?
Yeah, it turns out that Joe is studying the way his digital demodulator works. He told us what brand name it was. Insignia brand. And he realized that it's looking for the local oscillator of the digital transmission. It searches across 250 KC, looking to lock up on that oscillator. He's discovered that he can stop that searching mode if he gives it a carrier of minus 120 dBm. It stops the search. It looks like it's happy, but still requires a hell of a lot stronger digital signal, overall power, before the system really locks up and gives him digital demodulation. I was guessing that the carrier that it's looking for, if he tried to inject a phony carrier, that's not enough. It's got to be phase locked to the original digital transmission in order for the Trellis demodulation to work correctly. That was my guess, and maybe you can confirm or deny. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Right. Well, let's not forget that a digital receiver is really two devices. When it's doing a search and it looks for something, it starts off by looking for the pilot, which is basically a single carrier without any modulation on it. The receiver's ATC gives an indication to the computer. Don't forget there's a microprocessor in the process of all of it. And that's the first thing it looks for. When it sees that, we'll actually activate the ATC in the receiver, and it will try and move its VCO so that it's sitting right on top of the pilot. And by the way, most of these receivers will swing like a megahertz plus or minus because the offset that we used previous to the digital transition was a frequency that was calculated to minimize the interference to an analog signal that would be right next to it, to give you an example. Our analog was on 21, and our digital was on 22. You have a long way to go after you get that VCO to lock up and against the pilot before you even start to think about demodulating the digital stuff. So, I think you said it was like minus 100 or 120 dBm, which is like a ridiculously weak signal. Might be enough for some receivers to say, oh, here's a pilot. And it'll start its focus right there. But there's several more stages that you have to go through before you actually get to even worrying about being in phase and decoding the symbol.
Now, for the people who are tuning into this particular subject for the first time, let me bring you up to speed. Turns out that Joe, W2RY, is YYY is one of the very few guys on Long Island, New York City area, who is doing digital television DXing. And he's received some digital signals from very long distances with the right support from Mother Nature's propagation on that particular day. And he's using somewhat modern equipment, modest equipment. He's got a Yagi-like television receiving antenna on a short tower on top of his house, and it's got a rotator. And he's got a reasonably good low noise amplifier, and what he believes to be a pretty good insignia brand demodulator. So he's able to see signals from pretty far away at times. And the discussion that Eric and I had a month or two ago was that to some degree, the public has been lied to. We were led to believe that when we switched over to, digital television, we would have the exact same range, so to speak. The people out there in Southampton with a moderately good antenna on a little bit of a tower on top of their house, who are getting a slightly snowy picture from Empire State Building, they were led to believe that when we switched over to digital television, they would continue to get over-the-air TV. Well, once we got into the real world of digital TV, where they lowered the power a little bit that they transmitted, they thought they'd be making it up with the digital signal processing, and the bottom line is anybody's more than, let me pick a number, 25 or 30 miles from New York City is not getting reliable communication when they're east of New York City on Long Island. So a hell of a lot of people think that they're forced to use cable television and other services like that. And even if you've got clear line of sight to Empire State Building, you may not be getting good digital television reception because the system is very vulnerable to multipath. And the discussion that Eric and I was having is that, is there a way that with global positioning, GPS satellites by which you can get exact frequency generation, you can discipline an oscillator, get on the exact frequency traceable to the Bureau, and if I was able to inject the pilot tone into my digital demodulator of a known broadcast signal with a known offset frequency, could I allow the system to suddenly be more sensitive and a little bit less vulnerable to multipath and therefore make up some of the range that has been taken away from me? So that's the discussion that Eric and I had, and we thought we had a good idea. We haven't done anything with it yet. Let me turn it back over to Eric to find out, now that we've thought about it a little bit more, is the idea crazy or is it still worth pursuing? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, correct you on one thing. We don't really have to care about frequency. What we basically have to care about is clock time. Well, each tick of when a symbol is sent. When you use a GPS trained oscillator, we don't guarantee the phase, but we do guarantee stability and frequency. So if we can say that we're going to take that 10 megahertz signal and divide it up and make edges that that occur at the same rate as the individual symbols, we have a way to store the phase of it, then we can actually continue to clock at that rate, and as the signal comes and goes, if you have multipath, then we can adjust where it is in the right spot and always maintain it in the right spot, we can eliminate some of the problems. But they're not thinking about that. We're now on to DTV version 3. There's a new ACS3 standard that's coming out that allows us to go to, say, within the same 6 megahertz.
And give us a little bit more audio if you can, Eric.
Sorry, is this better?
Tremendously better. Go right ahead.
I forget about this noise canceling microphone. If we can guarantee that that this particular nanosecond in time is where the symbol begins, we can always clock it in exactly the same place, even when you have multipath or you have fade or you have atmospheric conditions, you still stand a good chance of decoding that signal. Even though you might be getting errors, you might be getting blocking and stuff like that, but you'll still, it'll be equivalent to watching a smelly picture, so to speak. But now we're on to DTV version 3, which will allow for MPEG 4, which means it will now be able to transmit 1080p. There's another version of it that will allow us to transmit a 4K picture. And it also includes another set of pilots, which will help to determine multipath and overcome those situations, which is not backwards compatible, and that's where there's a lot of stuff going on to try and create a system which can coexist with the existing system. And I'm not sure if you're aware that we now have mobile digital television, which is within the same stream, but is not susceptible to the multipath and the other problems that we have with the main digital stream that we use today. So there is a lot that's going on, although our idea is really good, but it's going to become passe in, say, 10 years or so. KTRIWK2J.
That sounds good. Is that genius, Mr. Spagnoli, who is responsible for an awful lot of the protocol of our current digital television over-the-air broadcast system, was he involved in this digital TV version 3, which has, I think you said, it's got more pilots, a little bit less vulnerability to multipath. If I hold my breath, is some of the range going to come back? Is there going to be improvement in the system? Am I going to have my cake and eat it too? I'm going to have as many as nine streams of information on one 6 meg frequency bandwidth with digital television, and I'm not going to be requiring, right now, a serious television watcher over the air broadcast does require, in my opinion, a rotator on his antenna. So because of the particular propagation that's going on tonight, he wants to be able to carefully rotate that antenna so that the peaks and valleys and knolls in that antenna pattern can be steered in the direction of the multipath, which currently is giving a lot of grief to the digital demodulator. So I think you're telling me that the cavalry's on the way. We can hear the bugle. They're coming over the hill, and there is improvement on over-the-air digital television, and over-the-air digital television broadcast will continue, and it's not going to become obsolete. I want to hear words along those lines, Eric. I'm hoping. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2RWK, true game. One thing, you're still in the Stone Ages with the things that you're observing with your tuner. Okay? If you go out and buy a modern day flat panel TV, LCD, LED, plasma, whatever you have, that of recent manufacture, you'll start changing your tune about how you watch television. That's the first thing. Okay? No, it has improved over the demodulator that you're currently using. So, and also, when you go into other parts of the United States, they don't have the issues that we have here because of the terrain. And the other thing is, you said that we lowered the power. In essence, we really didn't lower the power. I'll give you an example. If I would have converted my 60 kilowatt analog transmitter to DTV, it would be equivalent to a 7 kilowatts. It would be equivalent to about a 14 kilowatt transmitter, DTV. The amount of energy that we're using to generate that signal will be the same as the 60 kilowatt transmitter, except that now the energy is evenly spread across 6 megahertz as opposed to being focused at one singular carrier frequency and 10 dB down one singular audio carrier. So we didn't actually, in essence, lower the power. I just want you to get that out of your mind.
Let me challenge you a little bit on that one, Eric. You have to pay a pretty big electronic bill to Long Island Power Authority, LIPA. You used to pay a bill that fed a 60 kilowatt transmitter. You consumed, after we account for the efficiency of your
stage, you consumed a good, let me assume that you had 40% efficiency, you were consuming 100 kilowatts of LiPa power to run that transmitter. The current transmitter, digital television over the air broadcast, is not consuming 100 kilowatts of power. If it did, I think some of the people would be having additional range if the system wasn't vulnerable to multipath. So when it comes to conservation of energy, when it comes to the efficiency of the final stage, assuming it's somewhat similar, now I may be wrong on that one, where your electric bill went down, are you sure that you really still regained the same amount of power? K2EJ, K2LIW.
Who said my electric bill went down? Okay. In the city, I'm using the same transmitter that runs at 28 kilovolt. The beam current is about 3 amps per cabinet, and it's 3 amps whether I'm doing analog, and it's 3 amps if I'm doing digital. What's the difference?
Okay, I'm going to give you an example of that. You and I are running a ground station, an uplink, which requires 600 watts of power at 12 gigahertz or some crazy number like that. And depending on how many decibels I back off on the peak power capability of the final traveling wave tube determines the amount of linearity I get, the amount of group delay distortion, a whole bunch of things with reference to amplitude and phase linearity. I can be consuming the exact same amount of power, but getting a hell of a lot less power output because I've had to back off in order to guarantee that linearity. So I'll admit that just looking at your LiPa bill doesn't quite answer the whole system. If I poured your power output of your old analog transmitter into a dummy load, and I measured the heat of the dummy load, and now I take your new digital transmitter and pour that power into a dummy load, will the dummy load give me the exact same amount of heat? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Now we can actually do something that makes sense to you. Just consider this, that the peak energy in the analog transmitter, with no modulation, is basically a single carrier at a single frequency. When I modulate it, okay, the single carrier, and we use, of course, sync as the peak energy, because of the frequency, it still keeps that carrier centered on the frequency that it's transmitting on. And if you look at the sidebands of a brick, it goes way down in terms of power. Right? So I consume X amount of watts to make that transmitter operate. And by the way, those Quietrons or tubes that we're using are tuned so that you have the minimum group delay, the bandwidth of it, if you sweep it, it'll be 6 megahertz. And it'll have some wiggle in it, but it'll mostly be less than a half a dB from the start of the frequency to the end of the frequency. Right? Now, I am using that same amplifier to transmit information that's not centered around a single frequency, but it has an equal amount of power all across the 6 megahertz bandwidth. And the reason for that, of course, is the random number generator that we use in the process of doing the transmission. So in terms of the amount of electrical power I consume, it's the same. But if I use a thermocouple type meter, or if I boil water and I do it thermally, I'm still generating that same amount of heat. I'm still generating that same amount of power, but the apparent power that we're looking at seems lower because it's, you know, across the 6 megahertz, but in reality, the amount of energy that's coming out is still the same.
Eric, that's very encouraging sounding. So you're telling me the dummy load with the digital over-the-air broadcast transmitter today versus the 60 kilowatt analog transmitter of yesterday, a couple of years ago, you're saying I'm getting the same amount of I squared R heating of that dummy load, therefore the real amount of average power you're transmitting into that antenna and into the ether is essentially the same today as it was 3 years ago. I think that's what you just told me, and that sounds very encouraging, and therefore that so-called argument of mine goes down the tube. Over to you, Eric, KQLIW.
No, I'll consider this. If you had a filter with very sharp shoulders, okay, that started at, say, zero and ended at 6 megahertz, in there, I can put a certain amount of energy. Either I can focus the energy at a single frequency, okay, or I can take that energy and spread it across the whole 6 megahertz. The total amount of energy coming out of that filter would, in essence, be the same. Although, when I'm putting energy at that single frequency, in terms of what I'm looking at amplitude-wise at a single frequency versus taking that single frequency and making it operate over the 6 megahertz, it looks like it's lower in level, but it's not. It's across the 6 megahertz, and the total amount of energy is equal to the total amount of energy that's being generated by the single frequency carrier.
Fantastic. Okay, what we're discussing here, if you've ever looked at the television broadcast signal over the air, analog days, with a spectrum analyzer, you saw a huge amount of energy, 1.25 megs above the low end. That was the so-called carrier frequency. 4.5 megs above that, you saw another great big chunk of energy, 9 or so dB weaker. That was the audio frequency, carrier, and so on. And then depending on whether they're transmitting a checkerboard or just a grayscale, you then saw a whole bunch of other components scattered around those two carriers. That was an old analog television. You look today at digital television, everybody who's smart enough calls it the Marquette display. In other words, Marquette. In other words, it looks like Marquette's haircut. The energy comes up a fraction of a megacycle from the low end. It looks like random noise, thoroughly flat random noise across essentially 6 megacycles, and then very rapidly falls at the high end, 6 megs away, and very fancy filters to make sure it doesn't flow, any of that energy doesn't flow into the adjacent channel. So on a spectrum analyzer, the new digital television looks very different, but if I measure total power flux density, energy density per megacycle of old versus new, and integrate across the whole 6 megacycles, Eric is telling you you're going to get the same answer. Put it into a dummy load, you're going to get the same amount of heat. So as long as you use the right, let me drop.
Can I make a comment on some of this stick?
As long as you use the right method of assessment, he's telling us that we're putting out the same amount of power. So when it comes to Joe and I and others looking for methods by which we can get rid of some of the vulnerability to multipad and make the new digital receiver lock up correctly, we're still discussing ways of doing that so that more successful over-the-air digital DXing of television signals could be possible. Go right ahead, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW. Look what you got us into.
I understand you keep on going back to this multipath thing, thinking that it's a critical thing that's going to actually define whether the thing works or doesn't work. I can sweep my antenna like 20 degrees or so, pretty much from either side of New York, and I can still get the picture to lock up from all the New York stations because I got such a strong signal initially coming in. Now, if I had multipath to be such a severe problem, going 20 degrees either way would be the defining factor, and I wouldn't be able to lock up the picture, but yet I can. Yet there are stations that are past that where it's simply a matter of amplitude. There are some stations from, say, New Brunswick, like on RF Channel 51, some days I can get the RF signal, it was strong enough to come through, some days it's not. The signal there is just simply just low in amplitude. But I'll tell you something else that's, that I'm noticing, and it's becoming quite pronounced in the whole area, of course, from what I've seen. I don't know how any of these TVs are going to be able to deal with this, because they were originally meant to pass like a fairly wide band of frequency along the converters. Currently we stop at RF 51. There's a lot of RF energy being emitted from many of the carriers in the 26 to 20, in the 726 to 738 meg band, and about 744 to 756 megahertz band. I think it's like either AT&T and Verizon up there. And I'm starting to notice that these signals are becoming very, very strong in the band. And that may be a very important fact to consider in some locations. You may have one of these stations right on top of you, or right in the beam path, where it's starting to overload your TV when you tune it to some frequency, where the signal you're trying to, you know, receive is there, but those things might be simply overloading your TV set or your decoder. And I have to use filtering when I originally put my stuff up a long time ago to purposely cut this stuff off. I put a filter that starts rolling stuff off above 700 meg, knowing that they would not be transmitting above channel or up channel 51 at some predetermined amount of time. Back to you, Dick.
Very good information, Joe. Joe is also one of these lucky guys who lives in Great River, Long Island. The terrain in front of him, by my standards, is relatively flat. Also, Great River doesn't have a whole lot of tall buildings, water towers, and whatever. From my location in Dix Hills, I'm living in a hilly territory. I've got a major hill to my west that gives me quite a bit of multipath to Empire and World Trade. I've got a local water tower a very small fraction of a mile away. I get a lot of multipath. And now let me give you one other example. For Joe, doesn't see very much detrimental effects of multipath. I was at Eric's broadcast station one day when he was using the antenna, a television receiving antenna that's on the side of the broadcast tower, which had line of sight to New York City. In order to get clean digital television reception, I watched Eric rotate that antenna back and forth in order to get the right signal-to-noise ratio, signal-to-multipath ratio. Maybe it was an earlier version of a digital demoduler you were using at that time, Eric, but even with that world's best antenna, receiving antenna location, from not very many miles from New York City, where you are in Plainview, I watched you rotate that antenna to get good digital television reception. Was that just because it was an early version of the electronics, KE2EJ, K2LAW, and the TechNet?
Yeah, KYWK2J. The receiver that I was using is actually a broadcast monitoring receiver, which is actually less than third generation equalizer. Actually, I put a new set in there, about 4 months ago. And you can literally spin that antenna around and hardly notice. But, yeah, the receiving equipment has a lot to do with it. Although, where I am, I mean, we would basically have this huge water tower that's slightly off to our left. It's a major source of multipath, and it's actually quite strong. So, the newer receiver seems to have much less of a problem with it than the stuff that I was using when you were there.
Very fine, Eric. Okay. It looks like I'm in the dark ages. I have to pull myself up to the 21st century with the electronics that I'm using for over-the-air broadcast digital television reception. And if I and my neighbors did that, if I was really using a 2013 fifth generation or whatever, seventh generation demodulator with a modern flat-screen TV, give me a guess, with a ordinary on-the-chimney mounted television receiving aerial, looking for New York City reception, would I have 90% reliability in Huntington? Would I have 80% reliability in Smithtown? I know this is a difficult question to answer. I'm asking for a gut feel. With modern-day electronics, has the range detriment that we used to have that people complained about and therefore they gave up on over-the-air broadcast, and for a bunch of other reasons. They want 40,000 channels and they want the HBO and Cinemax and all these other premium things. But however, for us hardcore people who just love over-the-air broadcast, has the range been extended with the new electronics? Can my aerial on my house in Smithtown get reasonable reception? KE2EJ, K2LAW,
WS2N.
We're going to use it in a second.